Hi, welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva, and we are continuing our study of part two, section two of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. The series is sponsored by our friends, the Betas, Michael and Tiffany Beta, in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichrono Livracha. Rabbi Soloveitchik, again, in this second part of the work, is describing one particular, perhaps the hallmark characteristic of halachic man, and that is his creative capacity. His creative capacity, Rabbi Soloveitchik's, halachic man's creative capacity. And expanding on what he was talking about last time, in an almost homiletic way, and reviewing some themes that he had touched upon previously in the first section, he goes on to talk more about man as a creative being. Man, the crowning glory of the cosmos, approaches the world. When he approaches the world, he finds his task at hand, the task of creation. Now remember, we discussed last time that for Rabbi Soloveitchik, as opposed to the Rambam, the manner in which we, as the pinnacle of creation, as the created being, humanity, as the created being which most approximates God, which is the creation, which is in God's divine image, is expressed principally through the fact that we too are creators. Halachic man or man must stand on guard over the pure, clear existence, repair the defects of the cosmos, replenish the privation, replenish that which is lacking. That which is lacking in being. Man, the creature, is commanded to become a partner with the Creator in the renewal of the cosmos, complete with the ultimate creation. This is the deepest desire of the Jewish people. I'm sorry, how's Ezra? Is there a problem with the sound quality?
Yeah, we're still getting static.
What do you suggest?
Maybe move your wire a little bit.
Move the wire.
And move the connection. Make sure it's plugged in all the way.
Yep.
From your computer to your.
Yep. Seems to be.
Okay. Actually, sounds better. It's better now.
Okay. The scriptural text at the beginning of the second chapter of Bereshit. The heaven and the earth were finished in the host of them all. Pasuk that we all know from Kiddush. The Targum, the Aramaic translation of the Torah, translates Vayechulu, were finished, that God created, he completed the act of creating the heaven and the earth, is translated into Aramaic by the Targum as Ve'ishtachlelu. Were perfected, were made whole. So that commentary woven into the translation is both a profound expression of the soul of the people and the most fervent desire of the man of God. That creation, to be creative, is to be a perfecter. This lofty ontological idea illumines the path of the eternal people. When a Jew on the Sabbath eve recites the Kiddush, he testifies not only to the existence of the Creator, but also to man's obligation to become a partner with the Almighty. So we're all familiar with this idea that the Kiddush, reciting Kiddush, is testimony to the fact that God created the world. That God is the creator of the world, that we encounter him as the creator of the world. But the Rav is saying that the recitation of Kiddush is also a declaration of man's obligation to be a partner in that creation. Just as the Almighty constantly refined and improved the realm of existence during the 6 days of creation, so must man complete that creation and transform the domain of chaos and void into a perfect and beautiful reality. And this theme, the transference, the transformation of chaos into perfection, the transference, the transformation of void, of tohu vavohu, into beauty, is the definition, becomes a definition of creation. And now there's this extended, well, tikkun olam, but tikkun olam is a kind of phrase which has taken on all different types of meanings. But in the simplest meaning, yes, tikkun olam, to repair the world, to perfect the world, lahashlim et ha'olam. Not tikkun olam in the kind of social justice sense as it's come to mean. I don't mean that disparagingly. I'm just saying, colloquially, that's how tikkun olam is widely interpreted today in the Jewish world. But here, tikkun olam in a much more primordial sense of acting creatively in this world. And remember our discussions of Adam the Second in Lonely Man of Faith for a description of what that role might be. When a Jew goes outside and beholds the pale moon casting its delicate strands of light into the empty reaches of the world, he recites a blessing. We're talking about Kiddush Levana. And the rest of the chapter becomes a kind of extended midrash or a reading of Kiddush Levana. If you're unfamiliar with Kiddush Levana, so take a look in the Siddur. It usually appears at the end of the Shabbos section before Havdalah. And once a month, usually on the Motzei Shabbat following Rosh Chodesh, we go out and we look at the new crescent moon, and we recite a blessing, which is accompanied by other texts and Tehillim and other things as well. But it's reminiscent of, and the Rav doesn't spell this out exactly, but it's reminiscent of the very, very well-known Midrash, which we know through Rashi, of course, about the creation of the sun and the moon. Briefly told, according to the original plan of creation, the sun and the moon were meant to be co-equal. The moon, having complained, and there's a kind of textual impetus that's motivating the Midrash, not necessary for understanding our section now. The Torah describes the sun and the moon as the two great lights, as the two lights. And then it describes one as the Ma'or HaGadol, the sun, and the other one as the Ma'or HaKatan, the lesser one, the moon. So if initially they're both these kind of great lights, and then one becomes large and one becomes small, so the Midrash wants to know, how'd that come about? And the Midrashic imagination fills in a backstory that originally the sun and the moon were meant to be co-equal. And the moon complains. Can't be that two kings wear one crown. It can't be that in the universe, or at least in our solar system, there are two co-equal powers. And God punishes the moon. God tells the moon, you're right. You can't have co-presidents. You can't have two kings. And therefore, you will be made less. And the waxing and waning of the moon, the replenishing of the moon, takes on all types of mystical and later Kabbalistic notions that originate with that Midrash, the idea that the moon's return to her original size is an indicator of the redemption. And the symbolism of the moon as a symbol of the redemption, as a symbol of trying to return and recapture past glory, is already present there. That creation itself has been damaged, has been lessened. It's been lessened through sin, and redemption comes through correcting that. The natural, orderly, cosmic phenomena precipitates in his religious consciousness both melancholy thoughts and bright hopes. He contemplates the spectacle of the lawful cycle of the waxing and waning of the moon and sees in it a symbol of defectiveness and renewal. Just as the moon is defective and then renewed, so creation is defective and then will later be renewed, replenished. To be sure, God with his words created the heaven. He gave them a fixed time so they should not alter their appointed charges. This is a quote from the Bracha. We are not speaking here about any mythological notions, heaven forbid, but about the cognition of the natural law governing the course of the heavenly host based upon clear, precise astronomical knowledge. This is fascinating, because the Rav takes this text which is pregnant with mystical meaning, about an argument of a mythic argument between sun and moon, a midrashic argument between sun and moon. And the Rav says, we're not talking about that. I mean, that's not what interests us. What interests us is that the natural law governing the course of the heavenly hosts, that the way that the sun and the moon and the earth interact with each other, causing our view of the cosmos to be in a certain way, rotating and around gravitational fields according to principles and mathematics, gravity, that's creation. But embedded within creation is this larger idea. However, the law itself, the orderly movement of heavenly bodies, symbolizes a wondrous mystery. The very court which would make its astronomical calculations that the Bet Din in the times of Kiddush HaChodesh, when witnesses would come to Jerusalem to the Sanhedrin and testify about the appearance of the new moon, and the Bet Din would declare it to be Rosh Chodesh on that day, the next day, that the Bet Din, the very first mitzvah given to the Jewish people, the Bet Din becomes the arbiter of time and determines sanctity and determines that if today is Rosh Chodesh, then Yom Kippur will be in 10 days from today. And if tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh, then Yom Kippur will be 11 days from today. That we, as partners with God, we can determine time. We can determine the sanctity of time. We can determine the calendar. And in a different context, the Rav very famously describes, that's why the bracha on Shabbat is Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbat. God sanctified the Shabbat. Shabbat is holy whether we observe it or not. Every 7 days is Shabbat, whether we're aware of it. If all of the Jewish people, if the entire world were to forget Shabbat, it would still be Shabbat, with or without us. But not so the Zmanim, not so Yom Tov, not so the calendar, which is determined through the involvement of the Bet Din, through the involvement of the witnesses to make determinations. And this is, of course, the famous Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah and the famous Agadah in Brachot in the fourth chapter of Brachot, about Lo Bashamayim Hi. The very court which would make the astronomical calculations in the same manner as the astronomers who discern positions and motions of stars engage in calculations, they would go outside and recite a blessing over the new moon. The Jewish people see in the orderly and lawful motion of the moon, in its orbit, a process of defectiveness and renewal, the defectiveness of the creation and its renewal, its replenishment. They therefore whisper a strange, silent prayer. Yehi Ratzon, may it be your will, to replenish the defects of the moon so that there be no diminution, to return to the original order of creation. And then let the light of the moon be like the light of the sun, like the light of the creation, like it was before it was diminished. The Jewish people, by means of this prayer, give allegorical expression to their hope for the perfection of creation and the repairing of the defects of the cosmos, to their hope for the realization of that great and awesome symbolic eschatological vision. The light of the moon shall be like the light of the sun, which is a metaphor for Mashiach, which is a metaphor for the redemption of the whole world, of creation, of nature. In other words, it's this very, here's the embodiment of Torah Umada. Here's the embodiment of the modern Jew who's still entrenched in a world of faith, who's still a man of faith. The Sanhedrin were astronomers. They were scientists. That's what the Gemara says, that they knew exactly when the moon would be. They knew how the planets worked. They knew the calculations. But yet we still waited and relied on the witnesses, because that's the mitzvah of Kiddush al pi Re'iyah. And when the moon would be sanctified, which they knew mathematically, they were cognitive men. They were astronomers. But yet they still appreciated the mystery, the Agadah, the relationship between Halakha and Agadah, between Torah and Mada, to go out and to make this eschatological prayer, to say that you look into the cosmos, the orderly working of the heavenly bodies, and to see in it an allegory for creation and diminution and replenishment and redemption, to recognize in creation, in nature, the symbols of a kind of historical interpretation of the Jewish people, of all of human history. That's this fabulous hybrid of, you know, what most people would think is this coincidence of opposites. But no, that's how a halachic man stands above both. It's interesting that he doesn't go back and start, running through the paces of doing those comparisons, halachic man and cognitive man and religious man. Right? But there it is. There's halachic man acting as both the scientist and as the religious man who allows himself to look at the world in wonder. Right? He knows the math, he knows the science, he knows the astronomy, he knows when it's Rosh Chodesh. And yet, when it becomes Rosh Chodesh, he's filled with wonder at the waxing and the waning, at the up and the down, at the ebb and the flow of the tide and tide of history and of Jewish life and Jewish history and the desire for redemption, and knowing that sometimes things are dark and then they become brighter, and the desire to return to the original plan of creation where sun and moon are co-equal and can live in harmony as a symbol of being in a redeemed world without those ups and downs, without those ebbs and flows. Here we are on page 107. Examining matters from this esoteric vantage point, the Jewish people see their own fate as bound up with the fate of the existence as a whole. That existence which is impaired and cleft asunder by the forces of negation and nothingness. Physical reality and spiritual historical existence both have suffered greatly on account of the dominion of the abyss. I'll skip ahead. Man is obliged to perfect what his creator impaired. This idea that God willfully, intentionally left in creation work for us to do. Reish Lakish said, what is the new moon goat offering different in that the phrase chatat l'Hashem, a sin offering to the Lord, is used in connection with it, whereas ordinarily the phrase of sin offering is used, without the addition unto the Lord. In other words, when we're talking about the korban of Rosh Chodesh, the musaf of Rosh Chodesh, it has this kind of linguistic addition, that it's referred to as a chatat, a sin offering, and it's a sin offering for God. Now, the simple meaning of the pasuk is that it's a sin offering that we offer la-shem, to God. But again, midrashically, the Gemara reads it as it's a sin offering for God. The Holy One, blessed be He, said, the goat shall be an atonement for my diminishing the moon. In other words, on Rosh Chodesh, we have an opportunity to atone. There is that idea that Rosh Chodesh is a kind of mini Yom Kippur. You know, many people have this custom on Erev Rosh Chodesh, once a month at the new lunar moon, the new lunar month. An Erev Rosh Chodesh is a kind of, it's called Yom Kippur Katan, the mini Yom Kippur. But this idea that although Yom Kippur is the main day of atonement of the year, there are smaller stations along the way of Yemei Kippur, namely the Rosh Chodesh. And Rosh Chodesh served not just to atone for our sins, but to atone, as it were, for God's sin. What is God's sin? God's sin is having reduced the moon, of having punished the moon, of having introduced into creation from the very outset this imperfection. And the imperfection can be fixed through redemption. The Jewish people bring a sacrifice to atone, as it were, for the Holy One, blessed be He. And again, you have to add in all these as it were's, because we can't mean it literally. Obviously, God, of course, does not sin. It's not a relevant concept, and we're speaking here midrashically. And the sin was that He has not completed the work of creation. Because if He left something imperfect, or if He introduced the element of imperfection into creation, that is a sin. The sin, the mitzvah, the command, the obligation that we are under is to perfect, is to vayachulu, is to create and to perfect. And leaving imperfection, leaving the work undone, the Creator of the world diminished the image and stature of creation in order to leave something for man, the work of His hands to do, in order to adorn man with the crown of Creator and Maker. And He does this in order to leave room for us, in order that we may take up the task and act creatively. There's this lovely passage in footnote 114 here, which is this quote in passing from this Yiddish story by Peretz. Do I have it? Where did I put it? Here, one second. Let me just put it up. Yitzchak Leib Peretz was one of the most significant Yiddish writers of the early 20th century. The Rav was exposed to some of these Yiddish writers. There he is. Yitzchak Leib Peretz, 1852 to 1915. The Rav was exposed to some of these Haskalah, these figures of the Jewish Enlightenment, literary figures, Mendel and Moche Sparim, and Peretz, and Bialik, who was, of course, a great Hebrew poet. He was exposed to them in his youth. He was exposed to them principally through his mother. And they were things that remained with him, and that he would draw on them, possibly because he knew that they were things that still resonated with the audience that he was speaking to and writing to in mid-20th century America. And just as likely because some of those things were things that really did latch onto his soul and really did resonate with him. And he quotes this story. The story of a little boy. The innkeeper's appealing little boy with his jerky movements and his curls full of feathers still haunts me, says the narrator of the story. Now he stands before my eyes with a scallion in hand, and he wails. He wants another scallion. Or I hear him at evening prayer at Maariv saying the Kaddish in such a childlike, plaintively earnest manner that it pierces my very heart. Hopping on one little foot, he stretches his face upward to the moon. The little boy sighs. Did he see a star fall? No. Oh, he says, how I wish Moshiach would come. What? I want the moon to become bigger already. It's such a pity on her. It's true, she sinned. But to suffer so much, we are already living in the sixth millennium. We're already living at the end of history. We want Mashiach to come so that the moon can go back to being bigger. 6,000 years almost she's been waiting. She's been in her punishment. Altogether two requests, says parents. From his father on earth, another scallion. And from his father in heaven, that the moon become bigger. A wild impulse seized me to tell him, says the narrator, enough! Your father down here will soon get married again. Soon you'll have a stepmother. You'll become a stepchild. You'll have to wail even for a piece of bread. Forget about the scallion. Forget about the moon. And then the Rav comments, those downtrodden, often externally unappealing shtetl personalities, the itinerant peddler hawking his needles, threads, and thimbles in the villages of the paneled settlement, the plain, often coarse innkeeper, the fleshy villagers, were all nevertheless imbued with an inner bewitching attractiveness. An ember of holiness still smoldered in the hearts of those figures who were drowning in almost overwhelming, soul-crushing worries, pressures, troubles, a wondrous flame burning the depths of their being. Lit up their desolate and oppressed spirits. On the one hand, it seemed as if all they were concerned with were the few miserable pennies and bare physical necessities they had to struggle to obtain, like the abandoned, lonely orphan boy, soon to be the object of the stepmother's wrath, who so longed for just that second scallion. But yet, on the other hand, they yearned for the reign of the cosmic righteousness. He goes on to describe it at a little greater length. But this idea that the dichotomy that the Jew was both simultaneously praying for redemption, but not redemption for himself, not that we should be rescued from this kind of stage of history that we're in, but that the world should be rescued. And on the other hand, also, by the way, I need lunch. I need another scallion to chew. Those of you that remember the other parrot story about Braunschweig, which the Rav would also comment on, we've talked about it before, is a similar theme. Braunschweig is this Jew, he's the holiest Jew of his generation, although he may be unaware of it. When he dies, he goes up to the Beis Din Shalmala, and they say to him, whatever you want, Bansch, you name it. What would you like? And all he can muster up is the energy to ask for a little roll with some butter. And the Beis Din, or God himself, cries and says, had Bansha asked that I send the Mashiach, I would have sent him right now. But that's the problem. When you're so hungry that all you can think of is wanting a roll with a little butter, it's hard to remember to ask that God should send the Mashiach. The perfection of creation, going back to the text on the bottom of page 107, the perfection of creation, according to the view of halachic man, is expressed in the actualization of the ideal halakha in the real world. Hold on. Here at the top, page 108. And once again, we see revealed before us the divergent approaches of the halakha and mysticism. While mysticism repairs the flaws of creation by raising it on high, by returning it back to the source of pure, clear existence, that's the motion of homo religiosus, of religious man, trying to escape this world and to return to that on high. Halacha fills the deficiency by drawing the Shekhinah down into the lowly world, by contracting transcendence within our flawed world. And then, slightly repetitive, there's this description of tzimtzum, of that contraction, which I'll skip because we did talk about it at great length earlier. Here, at the bottom of page 108, if a man wishes to attain the rank of holiness, he must become a creator of worlds. If a man never creates, never brings into being anything new, anything original, that he can't be holy to God. That passive type who is derelict in fulfilling his task of creation cannot become holy. Creation is the lowering of transcendence into the midst of our turbid or murky, coarse, material world. And this lowering, the bringing of the halakha down into this world, can only take place through the implementation of the ideal halakha in the core of reality. Realization of the halakha is contraction equals holiness equals creation. But man himself symbolizes, on the one hand, the most perfect, complete type of existence, the image of God. And again, remember, the image of God means that we too are creators. But on the other hand, man represents the most terrible chaos and void to reign over creation. This contradiction that one finds in the macrocosm between ontic beauty and perfection, between real beauty on one hand and perfection and monstrous nothingness, also appears in the microcosm in man. For the latter incorporates with himself the most perfect creation, the most unimaginable chaos and void, light and darkness, abyss and the law, a coarse, turbid being, and, on the other hand, a clear, lucid existence. On one hand, we are the beast, and on the other hand, we are the image of God. This is a theme that occupied the Rav throughout his life, the dualism, which is man, that we are both angels and we are animals, that we are like God, and we are no better than the beast of the field. All human thought has grappled with this strange dualism that is so pronounced in man and has sought to overcome it. From Plato and Aristotle, who distinguished between the nutritive soul, the sensitive soul, the rational soul, this is also an idea that's taken up by the Rambam in the Shmona Prakim, which we learned a while back, to the psychoanalytical school of Freud and his followers, who sought to probe the depths of man's subconscious. This problem of dualism keeps reappearing and demanding its resolution. Judaism declares that man stands the... And again, just to go back, in creation there is a dualism. Creation, on one hand, is law-governed and ordered, but it is holding back. This is the idea we talked about last time. It's holding back chaos and void. When God created the world, he did not remove tohu vavohu. Creation did not supplant tohu vavohu, chaos. It stands alongside. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz, and within creation, there is tohu vavohu. And creation tries to fill out the vacuum, holding chaos at bay. But yet chaos, disorder, creeps in. There's a kind of entropy at work. And that if we don't hold it back, it will overcome. And the force of creation is the opposite force to the force of chaos. And that tension which exists in creation, in the macrocosm, exists in the thing which is itself the very apex of creation and which is the microcosm of creation, and that is namely humanity. We are mishuchlal, we are perfected, we are complete, we are ourselves in the image of God, but yet even within us there is chaos. Even within us there is chaos. Right? And that dualism is something which is fascinating. Judaism declares that man stands at the crossroads and wonders about the path he shall take. Before him, there's an awesome alternative. On one hand, the image of God. On the other, the beast of prey. The crown of creation, or the bogey of existence. On one hand, the noblest of creatures, or a degenerate creature. The image of the man of God, or the profile of Nietzsche's Superman. And it is up to man to decide and choose. Rabbi Yishmael ben Tanchum said, after all the actions and before all the punishments, the Pasuk in Tehillim says, thou didst fashion me after and before. Rabbi Yishmael ben Tanchum said, after all the actions and before the punishments, if he proves worthy, we say to him, you preceded creation. Right? In other words, on one hand, man's creation was foreordained. If we fulfill our task, if we are worthy, we say that we are the blueprint of creation. We were there. We were the purpose of creation. But if not, then even a gnat preceded you. In other words, we are created at the end of the tale of creation. But the creepy crawlies were here first, a gnat, a snail. So on one hand, we're the crown of creation. On the other hand, we're the bottom of the pile. It all depends on which element of our personality we're accessing, angel or beast. Herein is embodied the entire task of creation and the obligation to participate in the renewal of the cosmos. The most fundamental principle of all is that man must create himself. It is this idea that Judaism introduced into the world. And our job to create and to be creative begins with ourselves. We are involved in the act of self-creation. I mentioned last time, that's the Rav's very definition of tshuva. Here we are, 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. 2 weeks before, 2.5 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. The season of tshuva. Tshuva is about recreating ourselves. It's about determining who do we want to be. Do we want to be angel or do we want to be beast? And that act of creation is itself redemptive for ourselves, for our communities, and for the entire world. And that's what we talk about creativity being an act in the redemption of the whole world. Okay, we will continue next week with part three, with section three, which is a further discussion specifically of this topic of tshuva. Tshuva as an act of creation and self-creation. So it's very appropriate for our discussions leading up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So try to read ahead in section three, starting on page 110 for next week.